meeting the minutes for March 1st.
Representative Swazinski moves the minutes for March 1st. Any questions, corrections? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 1390. And Representative Zerwas, I will move that before the committee to be re-referred to the general register. Representative Zerwas, welcome back to the committee. You were with us earlier this week, and we will turn it over to you for House File 1390. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1390 is a local bill having to do only with Sherburne County. Sherburne County is currently undergoing a very large capital project as we're adding a significant addition and doing a remodel to our Sherburne County Government Center. As the financing of that project is coming into place, it came to my attention that in one of the funds within Sherburne County, the Sherburne County Law Library Fund, there is a significant fund balance of over $400,000. That fund balance is stable and steady, and it is unnecessarily high. And so the request by our county board is to allow up to $200,000 to be removed from the Law Library Fund and allowed to be applied towards the capital improvement project. Mr. Chair, members, today Steve Taylor, the Sherburne County Administrator, and I think Mr. Taylor can add some more of the details around the fund, how that money accrued, and the project itself.
Representative Zerwas, thank you. Sir, welcome. You'll state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Steve Taylor, Sherburne County Administrator. So the bill language that you have in front of you was drafted by the Sherburne County Attorney, Kathleen Haney, and she also serves as a law library trustee. Currently, statute does not allow the law library to help with construction costs. This language was approved by the law library board. It was approved unanimously by the Sherburne County Commissioners. And as Commissioner Representative Zerwas mentioned, Sherburne County is in the midst of a $60 million construction project. That includes a new court swing. And within that new court's wing will reside a new law library. So we're asking for your support on this bill.
Thank you, sir. I also have on the list of testifiers Colleen Norgren. Is Colleen Norgren from Wright County here today? There she is. She's making her way down to the testifying table. Representative Nelson.
After you.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning and welcome. You'll state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
I'm Colleen Norgren, Law Library Manager of the Wright County Law Library. And we just got notice of this bill a couple of days ago, and I was not prepared to testify today. We were going to observe. But we, as law librarians, believe that Sherburne County already has this authority through their Board of Trustees. So this is very specific to Sherburne County, and we don't feel that there's a reason to actually change the statute itself when they already have the authority. Back in 1994, the Attorney General wrote an advisory opinion stating that the county is not authorized to require the Law Library Board of Trustees to pay for rent, and they are to provide suitable quarters within the courthouse. So through that opinion, the county is not authorized to require rent and must provide suitable quarters. We believe that they already have the authority through the statute itself. So in 134A12, hang on a second.
Sorry. Take your time, you're doing fine.
134A05 says that they are to pay for purchasing lease books or law library fees with money from the county law library fund. So we believe that they have the authority to pay for facilities as the statute stands, and the statute further down, also the proposed writing of the new bill is contrary to subdivision 12 of the statute that says the law library fee is a cost in the action and taxable as such and is to be allotted for the support of the library. And right now it's written as courts as well. We also have some precedent for this in Wright County. On December 18th, 2002, Wright County Board of Law Library Trustees authorized a payment to the county of $75,000. So that's the precedent that this has already taken place in other counties. We don't feel that there is a reason to actually change the statute to benefit one county and one transfer.
Ms. Norgren, thank you for your testimony. Representative Zerwas, did you want to respond to the testifiers' assertions, or maybe Ms. Dyson can help us with some
backgrounding? Mr. Chair, members, I was requested to carry the bill on behalf of the County Board of Commissioners. The Sherburne County Attorney wrote the language and believes that they do not have the authority to make the transfer for the capital fund without this legislation. If you look at lines 1.7 through 1.11, it doesn't mention Sherburne County specifically. It talks about a county law library that has fiscal reserves that it can sustain for operation over 5 years. The county law library may transfer up to half the money in its fiscal reserves, but not to exceed $200,000 to the county in which the library is located to defray cost of constructing a new building to house the law library and courts. I don't believe that's an existing language. I think that would be an expansion of existing language. That's why we're here today. This bill was heard and passed unanimously in the Senate.
Ms. Dyson, did you have any information for the committee on the matter as to whether or not assertion that the county already has the authority, as Ms. Norgren has testified today?
Mr. Chair, members, at this point, I do not have information on that. I can get back to you, but what I would point out is this is, by adding it to statute, it is not specific to Sherburne County. This would apply to every county at any point in the future.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Nelson, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it's a series of questions, because not being an attorney, I don't know how our law library, Ms. Norgren, how are law libraries currently funded? I mean, are they through fees, charged uses, are they fees that are tacked on people filing lawsuits? How are they funded?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative, they're funded through collecting law library fees attached to court filing fees and some parking tickets. So anytime a probate matter or divorce or criminal action is filed, there's a $10 law library fee that is published in the state register, and it's not consistent across the board. Counties have different amounts that go to there.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they, county by county, could set those fees on their own because they're different fees. I thought I heard you say they're not authorized, the counties aren't authorized to charge rent, or did I hear that wrong?
That is correct. That
Ms. Norgren.
Is the opinion, sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative, that is the opinion of Kenneth Rashke in an Attorney General opinion to settle a matter in Ottertail County.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm thinking back to my school district many years ago. They had leftover money from their bonding projects they had done, and they used that without authorization from the voters to put up a office building to move their school district offices out of, it was actually in one of the high schools, and to create more space in the high school, but they built this building to put their central offices in there, and it caused quite a stir in the school district and in the area. And I guess when I'm looking at this on the question, the concern I have is what would stop a county from setting a high fee to build up a huge reserve so that they have a slush fund there to build buildings and for themselves and something they can tap into if they're authorized, if we pass this bill. And I guess that's just a concern I have looking at this and the way what I'm hearing in the testimony. I'm not saying that that's not what Sherbert County did. I'm not accusing anybody of that, but it's just, I mean, it could be a way to go around the voters, to go around taxpayers in the county, to create a fund so that now we have money to do capital projects for the county. And I don't know if that's more of a question or concern, but it's just or a statement, I guess.
Representative Nelson, before I go to Representative Zerwas, my thoughts on your comment are the fees from traffic tickets and stuff are set by state statute and those kinds of things. So the state would have a hand in those fees, parking fees, some of those kinds of things set by a local unit of government as well. So I think there might be some checks and balances just off the top of my head, not being an attorney and digging deeply into this as well. But those are just my thoughts. Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chairman, members, I do want the committee to recall what County Administrator Taylor said as far as their capital project. Sherbert County is in the midst of a $60 million capital project in which the state courts, are getting new courtrooms, new chambers for the judges. As a part of the $60 million project, the county law library is being moved. $200,000 out of the $60 million project hardly seems like incentive to exorbitantly raise fees and do that type of nefarious activity. So I would count that as highly unlikely, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ross, do you happen to have a total cost for the project by chance?
It's $60
million. I thought I might have heard that somewhere. Representative Nelson.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, and like I said, it's just first blush. Like I said, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know deal with this, and I don't deal with that. And I'm just, like I said, different things have happened, and it's, like I said, going on past experience, like I said, with the school district, they took extra money they had, and they built this without voter approval, and it's just, maybe I'm looking at it wrong, and maybe I'm being more skeptical, but oftentimes we have issues where we want transparency in how we pay for things, and transparency in government, and pay for it, and it's just, I don't know if this is, I mean, it may be the right way to do it, but I'm just raising questions because I don't know.
Representative Nelson, to the issue of the school district using that, there may have been some special legislation that would allow for those kinds of things that would be outside of the area of this particular statute. I'm just speculating. I don't know either,
yeah.
But I don't want people walking away from here thinking that school districts are using money that they're not supposed to for projects that they're not supposed to as voters approve. There may have been separate legislation or codification in the education statutes that makes that permissible. I don't know. I just don't want people walking out of here thinking that government operation says that school districts are stealing money from their
voters. And Mr. Chair, if I may,
Representative Nelson.
If I remember, my memory, this is many years ago, but if I remember right when this happened there was some voter outrage, and there was, you know, one of the checks and balances we always have is the voters have their say, and if I remember right, there was a huge turnover of the school board the next election. So, anyway, I'm just trying to raise it to make sure that, that we're not setting up a precedent where now the county board could say, well, this is a way we can raise taxes and raise money without having to go to the voters and fund things that we want to fund. So that's what I'm just raising.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. It seems like this is or should be a local bill, but I guess I'm wondering why it needs to be written in a way that could allow this. It sounds like there might be unique circumstances in Sherburn County, but this would apply to any law library in any of the other 86 counties in Minnesota. I'm just wondering, you know, we do local bills all the time. Why do we need to make a broad change to this? To this statute, why wouldn't we just do something to that would affect Sherburn County?
Representative Freiberg, before I ask the bill author, when I read the bill, I was thinking that this is putting in a provision for any county that has this meets the standard. Since we have 87 counties, we don't want a day like we had yesterday. We have 6 or 7 counties coming all at the same time asking for exemption from things. It may be something that would be policy statements versus individual circumstances. That's just my reaction, but I want to hear the bill author's thoughts on it.
Mr. Chair and members,
Minister Ross.
The Sherman County Attorney Kathleen Heaney is the past chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association that have dealt with these county by county statute changes in the past. And my guess is, with her vast experience with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, that was her intent, Mr. Chair, was to avoid that type of situation. Even though it's broadly written to incorporate the potential for any county to come forward, if you look at the parameters of where this is, having a fiscal reserve that can operate the law library for at least a period of over 5 years, it can only transfer half of that reserve with an upper end cap of $200,000, and then even then the money has to be used to defray costs of constructing a new building to house the law library and the courts. Even though it's open for every county, I think the set of circumstances that are then laid out below in the bill really narrow that window.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. If they are building up reserves to that extent, wouldn't the more logical thing be to decrease the amount of fees of the money going in?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Mason, it's my understanding that the County Law Library Board of Trustees is reviewing that. I also want to remind the members that this reserve was built up over the course of decades. And so it's not like there was a $400,000 surplus per year or annually. This reserve has been built up over decades, and so the idea that the fee is considerably out of alignment is probably not an accurate way of looking at this.
Representative Zerwas, to that point, my assumption is that not every county every county needs the law library. Every county has its purpose for the law library, but the amount of use in that library may be different at different times and based on the county's needs and the like. So to Representative Mason's point of adjusting fees, we would have to go back and adjust in Sherman County what we collect on traffic violations and moving violations and things. I think it's just the dollars that come in versus the dollars that go out, and it's on a county-by-county basis.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, if I could just add one more point to that. The Sherman County Government Center is a pretty small and aged facility that has a pretty small law library. And so I think the budget for operation is pretty minuscule. And so the idea is behind this is one of the great things that will happen with the, Mr. Chair, $60 million project is that they'll have a much nicer and more expansive facility to operate the law library in.
Representative Freiberg.
Well, I guess I'm just looking. I hadn't realized there's a whole chapter of the Minnesota statutes just dealing with county law libraries.
It's exciting stuff, Mr. Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I guess the you know, each in county, you know, the counties do collect fees that are, as near as I can tell, are specifically law library fees. And so I imagine they're marked as that purpose. When people pay court costs, there's a fee that's attached to that. And I don't know, I guess just setting a precedent to let some of the money there go towards courts more generally, you know, using what's marked as a law library fee for courts generally and not just for the law library. I can kind of see the concern that Representative Nelson was raising. It just seems like this could set a precedent. Well, I mean, it does more than set a precedent. It changes the law for all counties, I guess.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Freiberg, was that more of a statement, or did you have a question in that?
It was a statement, but if Representative Zerwas would like Representative Zerwas. To respond to it, I'm
and also, but before I take this, are there members of the public who are here today that would like to testify on the matter before the committee as well? If so, we're going to ask you to see James the page, and he will help you get queued up to be able to get up to testify. Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, I invite you to read line 1.10, where it says, in which the law library is located to defray the cost of constructing a new building to house the law library and the courts. And so it's an inaccurate statement to say that it's allowing money to go generally to the courts. It's not. It's allowing money that is located to defray costs of constructing a new building to house the law library and the courts. And so it's very narrow, it's very specific, and it's very prescriptive.
Representative Freiberg.
That's true. I mean, but there's, I guess I am still a little concerned just that there's no limitation. I mean, you know, if 99% of the fees could go towards the courts and 1% towards the law library, I mean, I imagine counties, you know, I imagine the county judicial system generally might have a slightly different agenda than the law library specifically. So I'm just a little concerned with how that the money could be distributed equitably in a way that is not anticipated when people are paying what is a law library fee. It's not an issue I feel immensely strongly about, but just a thought I had.
Other members of the public who would like to testify? Seeing none, other member questions? Seeing no other member questions, I renew my motion that House File 1390 be re-referred from our committee to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, you're on your way,
sir. Thank you, members. Members, this is the most controversial bill I'll carry all year.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 626, Representative Keel.
I think so.
House File 262. And as Representative Keel is making her way to the testifying table with her testifier, I will move House File 362 to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. If you will go ahead and state your name and proceed with your testimony on House File 262, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. House File 262 really is to work more extensively again on Alzheimer's and dementia. And it is, I'll briefly say, I don't think I'm telling anybody this, it is a disease that is challenging at best, and it needs many, we need research, we need to figure out what we're doing. It is a disease that we have no cure for. And we've done some things in the legislature to help us diagnose and help families to deal with it, but we would like to work more on this. And with that, we have a delete-all, Mr. Chair, that we should pass.
Members, you do have in your packets for House File 262 a delete, a DE1 amendment. And so to get the bill in the form that the author wishes, I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 262. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Keel, the bill is in the form that you would like before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at this time, I would invite Ms. McMullen to discuss the bill with us.
Ms. McMullen, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name, please, for the record, who you represent, to proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth McMullen, and I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota North Dakota chapter. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 262, and thank you, Representative Keel, for bringing this bill forward. Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disorder that damages and destroys brain cells, leading to loss of memory, thinking, and other brain functions. Alzheimer's is ultimately fatal. Over 5 million Americans, and including 91,000 Minnesotans, are living with this disease over the age of 65 today. And by 2025, that number is expected to increase in Minnesota to 120,000 over the age of 65. As the most costly disease in the United States, Alzheimer's is set to increase like no other. In 2016, the Medicaid costs in Minnesota for Alzheimer's were $767 million. And that cost in Minnesota is expected to increase to $1 billion by 2025. And the impact spreads further when you consider the family impact. In 2015, nearly a quarter of a million Minnesotans, friends and family members of those living with the disease, provided 284 million hours of unpaid care for those with Alzheimer's and other dementia. And the economic value of that $284 million is about $3.5 billion in Minnesota. And Alzheimer's is currently the sixth leading cause of death in Minnesota and the only one in the top 10 without a means to prevent, cure, or even slow the progression. So while researchers continue to explore the treatments and the cures, it's critical that we manage the impacts of this disease on our families, our communities, and our budgets, including the state budget. In 2009, the legislature created the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, and in 2011, that group made a set of recommendations to the legislature, and those recommendations fell into several categories, including early detection and diagnosis, quality of care, cost savings, training, education, research, some of the things that Representative Keel mentioned that the legislature has moved forward and helped us address. However, with any strategic plan, it's critical that we track progress and examine the impact. And this bill would assemble a working group charged to review and revise the recommendations in the report that was made to the legislature in 2011. A lot has happened here in Minnesota on healthcare reform and at our national level. So we want to ensure that everything that's occurred over the last 6 years since this report was given to the legislature, we've updated and addressed those. So by bringing together the appropriate group of stakeholders with the expertise in Alzheimer's and other dementias and asking them to review and revise the 2011 recommendations, we'll identify a clear set of next steps needed for policy and program changes to address the increasing number of Minnesotans living with this disease. The Delete All Amendment before you today does not change the substance of what we're looking for this working group to address, and that is your revision of that state, those recommendations made to the legislature. But it does focus the work of the group to issues specifically related to dementia and Alzheimer's. And it also adjusts the timelines. Originally we were looking at a pretty quick turnaround, so we've gotten some feedback that the quick pace of our timeline probably would not be possible, so we've extended the timeline slightly. And we're also looking at ways to minimize the cost of this bill moving forward. So I thank you and encourage you to support the motion before you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Ms. McMullen, thank you for your testimony today. Just a personal note, I'm happy to be a co-author on this bill. You worked with Representative Howell and Representative Knobloch, Representative Tice, myself, Senator Fischbach this summer, working with some individuals in our districts that really want to advocate for awareness on Alzheimer's related issues, and I'm so happy, Representative Keel, that you have taken this charge and brought it forward. We need to know more about this disease because it's going to affect many of us in many different ways with our families. So thank you for your efforts, and we appreciate that. Members, questions for Ms. McMullen or the author of the bill? Anyone from the public wishing to testify on the matter before the committee? With that, seeing no public testimony, no member questions, Representative Keel, I will renew my motion that House File 262, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the same sign. The motion carries. Representative Keel, you are on your way. Representative Albright, you are the next bill, and after that, we will be picking up House File 1530. So, Representative Scott, you are on deck after Representative Albright's bill is taken care of here. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1206 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. It is before the committee. Representative Albright, proceed with your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House File 1206 is the Traumatic Brain Injury and Spinal Cord Advisory Council bill. The purpose of bringing this piece of legislation before you this morning is found on bottom of page 1, as well as the top of page 2, where we are adding two members to the advisory council, one from the traumatic brain injury cohort, as well as another one from Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. Mr. Chair, I have spoken with the CA for your committee, and I note that there is the possibility that an amendment that was taken up in higher ed, where we were just last, may not have been engrossed onto the bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate if we could add the A2 amendment at this time.
Representative Albright, can you explain a little bit of the nature? Was this offered in a timely fashion in education and adopted, but is perhaps a clerical oversight? Is that what I'm hearing
from
you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes, that is absolutely the case. It was offered in a timely fashion, but for some reason unknown to the parties interested in this, it is not engrossed onto the bill.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, this was brought to my attention before the meeting, and I understand that you said that it was taken up and passed in the previous committee, just didn't get engrossed, and so it couldn't meet our 24-hour deadline. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A2 amendment to House File 1206. Members, questions on the A2 amendment? It looks like we're batting cleanup here for another committee, perhaps. Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Albright, the bill is in the order that you'd like, and I'll ask you to proceed with the genesis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, thank you very much for that cleanup. Thank you, Representative, for your assistance in that. Members and Chair, the bill before us today really continues some of the very most important work that I've seen in the areas of spinal cord injury and traumatic brain research that the state candidly smartly funded back in 2015. The current program is managed by the Office of Higher Education with a 12-member council, with the amendment that moves to 14 members of a council that works specifically on issues regarding spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury. These are experts in their field, and since 2015, eight grants have been awarded with the focus on functional recovery and rehabilitative techniques for these two areas of brain injury. This really is a unique program, members, in that we have fostered a public-private partnership with the funds that the state has invested. Three of the eight grants awarded have brought in an additional $1.24 million in external industry grants. The state funding was a seed money to get the research in motion and to develop those research parameters. I'm really actually very excited about this private-public partnership because the same types of funding streams that we are seeing through the Minnesota initiative in California alone have generated over $15 million in spinal cord injury research and seen $86 million in NIH federal funding, which have established a base for that research there. As we all know, both with University of Minnesota as well as with Mayo, Minnesota is a world-class leader in the area of medical research that leads to commercialization of the efforts based upon that research. Current market forces, candidly, are not adequate for some of the research because of the low population and lower return on investment compared to larger health issues such as diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. This is funding that can significantly help the future for those that are suffering from these maladies. Almost 11,000 people in Minnesota suffer from a spinal cord injury, and health care costs for those individuals range anywhere between $65,000 and $140,000 per year. I have testifiers in the room, but given the brevity of the amendment that thankfully Representative Nelson batted cleanup on, and for the purposes that we are before you today, they are certainly happy to expand on my notes, but I understand that you have a full calendar. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave that up to you at your discretion.
Representative Albright, thank you for the setup on the bill. If it's all right with you, maybe what we'll do is use them as resources, depending upon the nature of questions that members might have. Before I go to member questions, as I don't have any on my list right now, is there any members of the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 1206 as amended? Seeing no one approach the testifiers table, member questions for Representative Albright on House File 1206 as amended. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank Representative Albright for bringing this bill. I'm just so delighted to see the progress from the last biennium to this on this important issue for Minnesota. And I'm so proud, and I want to make a shout-out, even though he may not take the testifier stand today, to my constituent, Rob Wedluck, who has been amazing at the Capitol advocating for those with spinal cord injuries. And I just encourage the continued support, what his efforts here at the Capitol have done to inspire engagement of members, and the resources that have been brought as a result of the bill from last biennium into the state of Minnesota have been phenomenal. And so I just really applaud you for your work on this bill and for all of the advocates for this this work. Thank you.
Representative Puth, thank you. Other member questions at this time? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a statement. It looks, you know, we could probably get a whole lot of testimony here about brain injury stuff, but that's not the purview of this committee. The adding of two members to the committee, those seem to be appropriate and probably good additions that will help the committee do their work. So that's why it's here, and I think we should pass this on.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Seeing no other testimony or questions, Representative Albright, I will re-renew my motion that House File 1206, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Albright, you are on your way.
Thank you, members. Thank you very much.
And the next two bills that we'll have on the agenda are by Chair Scott, and we'll start with House File 1530. Good morning and welcome to the committee, Representative Scott. As I said, we'll start with House File 1530, which I will move before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register. Before we get started, I see that there's a DE amendment. Representative Chair Scott, is that your DE amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my DE amendment.
I will move the DE2 amendment to House File 1530 to get the bill in the order that the author would like. Any discussion on the DE2 amendment? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, looking at the DE2 amendment, it looks like it just makes this task force have to comply to the open meeting law and not every other task force. I guess the first question is that, am I reading that right? And then along with that, why just this one and not everybody else?
Representative Nelson, we are very fortunate because you have the bill author and the chair of the committee that deals with that, so let's ask her. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson. The reason for the change is the bill that would have taken care of, addressed all of the task forces that the legislature legislates for them to form. I felt that it needed a little bit more work. There are some task forces out there that are a little more nuanced than this child support one. And this really, the fact that the child support task force was not subject to the open meeting law, and that was sort of an oversight when the bill passed, was what spurred on the bigger, more broad task force. And in checking with House staff, I found that there's some really nuanced task forces out there. So I just felt like there was more work to be done on the broader bill. So I just wanted
Nelson.
To address this one.
Chair Scott. Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the task force that we're now talking about what is that task force? I believe I know what it is, but what is this task force that this applies to?
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, it's the Child Support Task Force, and it was established, I think, last year, in 2016, and it expires unless it's extended on June 30th of 2019. And just if I could further elaborate on what the task force does, it's the statute is 518A.79. It's a page and a half, but it was formed to study the issue of child support and the child support formula and so forth. And the reason that I felt uncomfortable being part of this task force and not having it subject to the open meeting law is just the nature of what we're talking about. Child support affects so many families in the state of Minnesota, and we meet during the day oftentimes, and the majority of the public is not able to have access to it at that time. So I wanted to make sure that we were able to record the goings-on of the task force so that the public had an opportunity to weigh in.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just when Chair Scott talked about nuanced and sensitive, I think she said nuanced, but task force that we have, and we have a lot that have deal with sensitive things. I would think from the people I know that have gone through divorces and gone through child support fights that this could probably be used as contentious as some of them are. So that's, but that's all. I just wanted to know why we just went to the one, and I think she answered the question.
We're really right now under the DE amendment to get the bill in the form that the author wants. We haven't moved it yet, but is yours to the bill itself? Okay, let's take care of the procedural stuff. It'd be Freiberg, then you, Akeem.
Mine is about the amendment.
Yep, that's perfect. Okay. I also wanted to, before we got too far ahead of ourselves, I have been advised that there may need to be an oral amendment to the effective date. Do we want to incorporate that at this time as well, Representative Scott?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I spoke with Mr. Koppel from DHS, and they are part of the task force. And I let members of the task force know that I was planning on bringing this. And he said they met, I believe it was February 22nd was the last meeting, and they meet during legislative hours, so I was able to attend part of the meeting, but not all of it. But he said at that time he did make the announcement that they were going to make it subject, you know, that the open meeting laws would apply. And so they're in agreement with this, and this just kind of puts it in statute. So especially as we move forward, that it's in statute. So I would like that just to go into effect May 1st.
So,
this year.
Representative Scott, if I understand your oral amendment, on line 1.14, after the word effective, strike January, the number 1, the comma, 2020, and in its place, insert May 1st, 2018. Is that correct?
17, Mr. Chair.
That's the amendment that you are looking for?
Right. Effective date would be May 1st, 2017.
17, that's okay. So then strike January 1st, 2018, and insert May 1st, 2017. I said 18, that's why I wanted to double check the date on that so we didn't have to fix it again.
Right, 17.
All right.
Thank you.
So what we'll do is we'll take that as an oral amendment. First, we'll go to the oral amendment to the DE amendment. All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed to the DE amendment, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. This kind of follows up on Representative Nelson's question. I mean, I just looked at the statute creating the task force. You know, it says it includes four parents, you know, among other people. I'm just, you know, are there sensitive issues discussed about individual parents' child support situations that may kind of chill the discussion there and make them not want to serve on the task force if it is subject to the open meeting law?
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To date, we've only really heard those stories from the public, and so those people are coming forth and volunteering their experiences with child support. And this is not everybody just telling their whole family law story. This is really just addressing how do we get the right formula for child support, to establish what the child support formula should be. That's really... and you can read on there to what the other things that we're tasked with, but that's primarily what we've been talking about. This last month and the next month, we're meeting with some economists to talk about how much it costs to support a child and raise a child today. So I don't think that the conversations that we have there wouldn't be any different than what we would have in the legislature, which is subject to the open meeting law, if that helps clear.
Representative Freiberg, follow up.
Yeah, just a second question, too. I mean, I guess it seems a little odd that we would apply this only to this one task force. I mean, you mentioned that this is an issue that touches many people. However, you know, we just heard about an Alzheimer's task force, a traumatic brain injury task force. I mean, those are certainly issues that affect a lot of people, too. It's just, I mean, how would you explain the discrepancy between different task forces?
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my understanding from talking to House Research and the people in the legislative, the LCC, Legislative Sally and her folks, like, what department is that?
Coordinating
Commission. Yeah. Thank you. not all task forces are created equally, is what I learned, and that's why I changed from being a broader, more, you know, broader bill to this one. And you could bring up the past testifiers and ask. You could look up the statute and see if those past task forces that were in front, just in front of you, whether those were open to the, or whether they were subject to the open meeting laws or not. And it's kind of a patchwork approach. And unless you address it in the bill, initially, it may or may not be. It just depends on who drafted the bill.
Senator Freiberg, any other questions to the DE amendment as amended? Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just maybe want to more of an echo statements that Representative Freiberg had said, and actually the discussion we had around the law library bill and how it just seems to be cleaner when we're dealing with things like this that we're doing it in a broad fashion and that we include all the task forces instead of having each and every one coming up after the fact. Or, as I understand what Representative Scott said, sometimes when a task force is put into place, the open meeting law may apply or may not apply, that we should, like, as a good public policy piece, maybe be looking at all task forces. I was a little disturbed to see that DE2 amendment come into and have this one particularly focused out. So just something to look at going forward, unfortunately, because it does kind of take a piecemeal approach. I don't think I can support it today, but I know you'll probably be looking into this in the future.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. My plan is to work on this over, so I have something together next year that addresses in more detail the broader sense of the word of the task forces.
Other questions to the DE2 amendment? If not, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment as amended to get the bill in the form that the author likes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Chair Scott, to your bill as amended.
I don't know if there's a lot left to say. I think I pretty well explained what the bill does.
Kind of figured we'd cover a lot with the DE, yeah. But procedurally wanted to make sure that we had our conversations here. Right. Members, questions? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 1530, as amended? Seeing no one approaching, Chair Scott, we will give you the final word.
I'd appreciate your support.
I renew my motion that House File 1530, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Representative Scott, you are on your way. Representative Scott, you have the next bill before us, and before we move that, members, since we finished House File, took our action on House File 1206 and this bill, I have been advised that we have sent it to the wrong committee. It actually is funded through the Higher Education Committee and not the Health and Human Services Committee, so we right now can save ourselves time on the floor if we move to reconsider that bill and send it to the right committee, or we can take everybody's time on the House floor and do that as a motion. I'll ask the committee what their wishes are.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to reconsider House File 1206.
As amended?
As amended.
Representative Nelson moves to reconsider House File 1206 as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? It is before us, and Representative Nelson, if you'd like to make the motion to send it to health and, or to higher education.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that House File 1206 as amended be re-referred to higher education.
All those in favor of the motion to re-refer the House File 1206 as amended to the Committee on Higher Education signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Scott, you have House File 179. House File 179, I will move that before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. Representative Scott, if you want to proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Ignition Interlock Program became law in 2010. It has been a great success and no doubt has saved countless lives by disabling the car of program participants when they attempt to drive after consuming alcohol. People who have had their driver's licenses canceled or revoked due to one or more DWI offenses can volunteer, although for some it is mandatory, to participate in the Ignition Interlock Program and have certain driving privileges reinstated. This allows participants to get to their jobs, treatment programs, etc. This last year, we learned that the Department of Public Safety had a new requirement for all devices to be wireless and provide real-time reporting. You cannot have wireless reporting without location gathering technology. Although my staff and I have discovered by talking to five of the vendors that do business here in the state of Minnesota that some vendors' devices can turn on and off the GPS technology and still provide real-time reporting, the fact remains that the Department of Public Safety, in my opinion, overreached its authority and may have violated certain program participants' rights by not informing them that they were potentially being tracked. Additionally, the Department of Public Safety went around the legislature by making a significant change in the program via rulemaking when they should have sought a change in the law. And this is reminiscent of other law enforcement agencies going around the legislature with other privacy or tracking type technology. For instance, we had the instance of cell phone tracking devices and license plate readers. And it was by citizens stumbling onto the fact that these technologies existed that the legislature was informed of it and was able to then make policy surrounding it to protect citizens to the extent possible. Since this revelation, the department ignored the requests and recommendations of legislators and stakeholders to set aside a January 1st, 2017 implementation of this new requirement until it could be more fully vetted. Only an injunction issued as a result of a lawsuit brought by one of the vendors that called into question the possible constitutional violations of this requirement finally stopped implementation of this new requirement. So what 179 does is it requires any new rules regarding just the ignition interlock program to have legislative approval. This bill also prohibits the use of devices equipped with location tracking capabilities unless the location tracking capabilities are disabled. This does allow the Department of Public Safety to have the real-time reporting that they were seeking. In the last committee, we also amended the bill so that it required ignition interlock vendors to provide separate notice to program participants that all the ignition interlock devices were capable of tracking their location. And also we had one that amendment that allows the location tracking capabilities to have it turned on if a court ordered it to do so. And that is currently happening in a couple of judicial districts in our state now. During the first week of session, the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee held a fact-finding hearing on this matter. We asked DPS why they wanted real-time reporting and the ability to track participants. They stated they had no interest in tracking participants. They merely wanted the report of someone who blew a bad blow in real time so these participants could be notified as soon as possible to let them know they're in violation and that their time on the program had been extended. Department of Public Safety said this real-time reporting would cut down on recidivism, and they showed us a couple of studies that they had to back that up. You may hear today from testifiers that location tracking can be a useful tool in stopping a participant who may be driving drunk and even having children in the back seat after the way the ignition interlock program works, you blow an initial blow. If there's no alcohol or a certain level of alcohol is not present, your car starts. But then they do intermittent rolling tests as you're driving down the road as well. So there may be some discussion about that today. Laws in other states may provide that you can send law enforcement out to find these people based on GPS and other tracking device data. It is not current law in Minnesota, and the Department of Public Safety has not asked for that ability. That would require a change in law and a separate discussion by the legislature and stakeholders. In summary, program participants cannot simply have the rules changed on them midstream, and DPS should not be making significant changes in the ignition interlock program without oversight and transparency. And those are my comments.
Representative Scott, do you have any testifiers today?
I do not.
All right. Chair Scott, I do have one person on the list, Mark Anthonson. Mark Anthonson.
He's the state
patrol. Oh, that was our previous bill. I'm sorry. He doesn't want to testify on this one either, so we're kind of in pretty good shape today. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee House File 179? Seeing no one coming forward, Chair Nelson, and then Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the promotion.
I do that every once in a while. Like I said, I remember you were chair of this committee at one time. So.
Anyway, Mr. Chair, the, Representative Scott, question I have is, been told that there are some people that have concerns about the bill, the way it's currently rewritten. Are you working with advocates and opponents to try and come up with compromises? I was told there might have been an amendment in this committee, but there isn't here. Are you going to continue working with the bill and working with the opponents and to try and come to a compromise or to a peace in the valley, as Representative Davis likes to say?
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I am open to talking to anybody that walks through my door.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, real quick, just so that I understand, too, this isn't going to preclude anybody from using ignition interlock if a device cannot be separated from the GPS or the GPS can't be turned off. I'm just worried that if this is the only way they're manufacturing them into the future, that we couldn't even contract with a vendor if they had GPS as part of the device.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joaquin. If this bill becomes law, the ignition interlock vendors would be required to have some sort of an on-off switch on their devices. And my understanding is all of them either have it or they're going to have it soon. And again, I haven't been contacted by anyone in that profession and that any of the vendors to come to me and say, we don't have this technology, we wouldn't be able to be a vendor here. So no one has come to me and opposed it in that fashion.
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, because that is a concern. I don't want us to be asking the technology to do something it can't and then having us not be able to use this program. Thank you.
Certainly.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank Chair for allowing me to speak on this, and thank you, Representative Scott, for carrying this bill. This affects a constituent of mine, and when this change was made, when we weren't even in the legislature, everyone was required to come in and get their car refitted, and then they are charged several hundreds of dollars in addition to the hundreds of dollars that they already pay to be a part of this program. So it was, and then they also have to go and report and connect this device to their vehicle. And before, it used to take about 10 minutes to get the information. Now it takes about a half an hour to 45 minutes to get all of this information downloaded to send to basically the government. And I'm very happy that you were able to move this bill forward, and I look forward to voting for it.
Other member questions at this time? And again, I'll ask one other time if there's anyone from the public that wishes to speak to the matter. And just for the committees, and please come down. We'd love to hear from you. And members, the portion of the bill that is truly within our jurisdiction is a section for the rulemaking provision, just for the record. Good morning and welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and provide us your testimony, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Fury. I am not a lobbyist. I am director of a nonprofit organization. I am here on my own behalf to testify positively with regard to this bill, in that I have known many people in the community who happen to have a disability or do not have a disability, who have been involved in this program. And it appears as though we need to move forward with clarifying the issues that are associated with the problems that have been reported by users of the system. Now, I realize that this is a policy bill. However, there are some significant issues with the system where the devices will go off in the middle of traffic, where they will stop the vehicle in the middle of traffic. I know of two people who have had accidents as the result of this device malfunctioning. So there's still quite a bit of work to do on it. However, whatever we can do as a community and as the legislature to move forward and improve the efficiency and effectiveness of this device, I believe that everyone who is driving on the highway would appreciate that. And that's really all I have to say today, is that it's important to hear from the community about how does this really work out on the street.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time to come down here as a citizen and share your thoughts. The legislature greatly appreciates, as does this committee, when people get actively involved in their government. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank
Members,
you.
Questions for the testifier? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chino. This is more a question for the author of the bill, and just in the rulemaking piece that we have here, that which is why it's before our committee. So as I read this, any new rules that might come down that might have to be promulgated, we cannot make any changes until they come to before us and we pass them. Legislation to do that. Is that how I'm reading this?
Chair Scott, to Representative Nelson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, yes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
So, a court order comes down that we have to change this program that makes the device, for some reason, makes the device, and I'm surmising here, but makes the devices unconstitutional or whatever the way they are set up now. That happened in the interim, we couldn't, this program could be stopped because we can't change any of those rules until we change the law. If that's how I'm reading this.
Chair Scott.
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but I don't know what, I would guess that a court order would trump almost anything that would affect any program that we might have. But a lot of times, I mean, if the court hands down an opinion of something, then the legislature has to take that up eventually and make the change.
Representative Nelson, my experience has been that we're constantly doing that here from different legislative all the different agencies where things are, and that's what keeps us in business.
Well, Mr. Chair, there's some truth to that, Mr. Chair, but sometimes that's part of why we have the rulemaking process, and I know the different levels of it, that some of that is so that they can, our departments that we've given them the task to do something, gives them some flexibility so they can make the necessary changes they have to do by going through the proper rulemaking processes that we have. But the way I read this is that if this happened, something happened in the interim, they would be hamstrung and they couldn't make the necessary changes until we took it up in legislation. So that's all, Mr. Chair. That's
Representative Nelson, thank you. Well, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Gehring to maybe give us a little bit more background on the question specifically. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, so there is the process you're referring to, is the good cause exemption in the rulemaking process in Chapter 14, and that allows agencies to adopt rules as necessary to comply with a court order to amend the rules in a certain way. Representative Scott's bill doesn't specifically necessarily provide for the good cause exemption, so I think as drafted currently, it would still require the legislative approval even for the good cause rules. But I think maybe what would happen is that you have to look at the actual court order, because sometimes court orders will direct the agency to act in a certain way, and so they would need to comply with whatever the court order says. Other times the court order might just say that the program's unconstitutional, and then you'd be then need to wait until you can come back and enact a law.
Chair Scott, and then Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I'd be glad to make that change.
We can't do that today, but you'll do that in transportation policy, which is the next next stop on this bill. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I understand, Mr. Gehring, because I am in transportation policy, so we'll be seeing this again.
We're going to count on you for helping this committee to make sure that happens.
Is to make sure that we still have the good clause exemption in there with the under Section 4, but the other rulemaking authority that's precluded from taking place until legislative approval is only having to do with the GPS as the bill is drafted, or is that how we're going to make sure it is drafted?
Mr. Gehring, do you understand the question?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, so the proposed amendment that Representative Nelson is referring to would clarify in Section 4 of the bill that the legislative approval isn't required for good cause exempt rules, and those are the rules that allow for compliance with the court order. The bill as drafted currently only applies to rules adopted for the ignition interlock program, so there's no other rules of the department that this would be subject to except for those that are adopted under this program.
Representative Joaquin, follow up.
So the clarification I would like to see, and maybe I can take this offline with Representative Scott, is it's my understanding the intention was that anything to do with ignition interlock with GPS would have to go before the legislature, but this is drafted that anything that changes in the program or any rulemaking cannot be done for ignition interlock until we are in session.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the latter.
Okay, so that does cause me a little heartburn because it's a really important program, and if something were to happen where when we're not in legislative session and because they can't do rulemaking, we actually have to stop the program, that does cause me some concern. But we can talk offline.
Potentially we'd have to stop the program because we don't know hypothetically the case that's going before the hypothetical court to comment on the hypothetical ruling by that hypothetical court.
Mr. Chair, it couldn't be court. It could be something else, too, not just court.
Well, it's not hypothetical. Chair Scott, did you have any other thoughts or comments? I'm out of member questions at this time.
No, I appreciate the discussion and the good suggestions, and I'd be glad to talk with anybody to make the changes that we talked about. And with that, I just ask for support.
And again, I see no other members of the public. Ma'am, thank you again for being here with us today and sharing your thoughts. It is always greatly appreciated when we have members of the public who are before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate it.
And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 179 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. You're on your way, Representative Scott. And Representative Sosinski, we are going to go to your bill, House File 1242.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1242 before the Government Ops Committee to be re-referred to the House bill.
To the General Register.
General Register, yes.
Representative Sosinski, you have moved the bill. I will turn the bill presentation over to you. I see we have a number of amendments. Are any of those amendments your amendments today, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one amendment. I'm not sure if there's others before. I have the A-17, and that is a product of many conversations between the interested parties and state local governments to kind of get the bill closer to where it needs to be. And I would like to move that amendment so that we can talk about the bill as I would like to.
Representative Sosinski moves the A-17 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would prefer to House File 1242.
Mr. Chair, I don't have an A-17 amendment in my packet. Maybe it's... I have an A-19, but not an A-17.
I've got an A-17, but not an A-19. Hold your cards. Oh, I'm sorry.
A-17-0119.
Is that clarify for everyone?
Oh, okay.
So we're all good?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was reading it wrong.
I will then, for clarification, move the A-17-0119 amendment for clarification to House File 1242, the author's amendment. Discussion to the author's amendment. All those in favor of getting the adoption of the author's amendment to get the bill in the form the author like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Sosinski, the bill is in the form that you would like. Please proceed with the presentation on your bill, sir.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll, for the opportunity to bring House File 1224 before you. This legislation really recognizes the partnership and responsibility by both parties, business and government, to work together to drive proactive engagement. This bill will drive business engagement at the local political process by providing better communication and transparency. The costs of business can really be significant when they're not aware of local hearings that will affect their licensure and their business practice. Unlike counties that are already required by state law to provide notification not less than 10 days before a public hearing on ordinances, cities have no requirement in Minnesota statutes that notify businesses regarding hearings on general ordinances that can significantly impact the operations in their bottom line. The amendment that we just passed that got the bill into the shape is really the culmination of a lot of conversations between folks in the business world and also some local government. It's not a cure-all, a fix, because there are obviously differences of opinions. But it really gets, from the bill as it was stated, some of the major differences is really the coordination of dates. Our bill initially had over a 14-day notification. We moved that to 10 to really get it in line to where the counties are at. And we really feel there was a lot of concern just on the technology and where we were driving small cities that maybe didn't use email or use a website. Maybe they have a static website. Would we have to upgrade? Really, that amendment works to alleviate a lot of those concerns. With that, if you look at the amendment, if a city uses technology that is no more than a burnt stick and a piece of parchment, it will not require them to change that practice when it comes to ordinances. But it does require that if there is a potential change to an ordinance that would affect their licensure, that they have 10 days to pre-post that so businesses can engage to reflect upon how that would affect them and engage their locally elected officials. I do have some testifiers here, but in the act of brevity, I know there's some folks with some concerns that would like to talk about it, so why don't we bring those folks in front, and if need be, we'll bring some of my testifiers.
Representative Swazinski, I have Keith Carlson from the counties and Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities.
They both come up?
Yeah, they certainly come up, and we'll get a chance to visit hear from them. And Mr. Carlson, we will take you first, because I don't see Mr. Carlson, so we'll take the first Mr. Carlson. Mr. Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee. State your name and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 833 of the 853 cities in the state. I want to start by thanking Representative Swazinski for working with us on the original bill and helping us work through some of the major concerns we had on the bill as first introduced. City officials, let me start also by saying the city officials agree with the basic concept that we want to make sure everybody, businesses, homeowners, renters, everybody knows what's going on. I think that's the goal of the Minnesota legislature. That's the goal of each one of our city councils, and they do encourage people to get involved, and we all should do that. The amendment that we have done today, I think, does, in fact, address many of the concerns we had in the bill. And we can have a separate conversation later about whether our current communications and publications requirements are adequate, but that's not what we're here to do today. We're talking specifically about this bill. As introduced, we were concerned that the bill would create a costly and cumbersome new mandate by requiring that we send out information to every licensed business within our community about any ordinance that may have any impact on their operation. Quite frankly, we were concerned that what would happen is that every city would decide, well, we really don't know all of the business aspects, we don't know everything the business is doing, so the recourse would be to send every ordinance change out to every business, which could result in a flood of information and confusion over whether the ordinance, in fact, has any impact on the business. But to comply with the spirit of the law, we thought there might be a rush just to flood information out there, which isn't going to do anybody any good. So with the amendment that Representative Swazinski has worked with us on, now we have an opt-in provision into the law that a business would opt into getting information rather than just automatically having that information show up in their inbox or in their mailbox. And it does create some carve-outs for cities that perhaps have less sophisticated technology, and we really do appreciate that, keeping in mind that I think our largest member is the city of Minneapolis. Our smallest member, I'm trying to remember which city is our smallest member, but I bet it has about 20 people and probably
the city of Ghent.
City of Ghent.
We're way bigger than 20.
Oh, okay.
You have 400.
But Mr. Chair, some of those small cities have a part-time clerk that must comply with all the laws that you pass. So we're looking at this from the perspective of the largest to the smallest cities, and Representative Swazinski and the retailers have worked with us to address those concerns. So with that, I would like to conclude by we thank, again, Representative Swazinski. And I've asked him if we identify any other issues with this language, if he would continue to work with us. We haven't had an opportunity to disseminate this information to all of our members, but he has agreed that if we identify some rough points with the language, that he will work with us to try to address those concerns. So, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my comments.
Mr. Carlson, thank you. This is going to the General Register, but my hunch is it's not coming up anytime soon on the General Register, so I'm sure that Representative Swazinski, as good to his word, he will work with you if you have issues that are coming up. Mr. Hagert, we will hear from the counties.
Yes.
Thank
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here just simply to thank Representative Swazinski and the interested parties for working with us and spending quite some time on getting through the differences and getting the bill in the shape in front of you today. So thank you.
Members, questions? I do have Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sweet. Some days you can do it and some days you can't. I just want to thank you again for bringing this bill forward. My husband and I have some rental property, and it just so happened in the city of St. Cloud that there was going to be a hearing and a moratorium on rental property, and being owners of several properties, we didn't hear about it. We heard about it from our realtor friends. And for us, it was really distressing because I think what they were talking about was more the college rentals and what was happening with those properties. And the properties that we have, I can say that none of them are college rentals, but they're mostly single moms. And so it was very distressing for us to hear that that was what the city council was talking about. So to have anything that would help, and I love the opt-in part of it too, because I'm an email person, especially now that I'm down here so much, but it's just really nice so that we can be aware of what's happening even when I'm not home, because my husband doesn't take care of this, so this wouldn't even hit his radar. So I appreciate the fact that we're moving towards better communication. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have no other member questions on the list, but I do have some amendments. Is there anyone looking to offer any of the amendments that are here in the packet yet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the remaining amendments were taken care of by the author's amendments, so I don't think they need to be put forward. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Nelson,
it looks like Representative Nelson,
just to make sure we are not taking the A1, the A2, and the A3 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Just procedure, you want to make sure we have that on the record. Representative Nelson, to your question,
Mr. Chair, with the delete all amendment that was put forward. The only concern that I would have with this is this taking us down the road of going to all email or all only web-based, computer-based notifications from cities. I understand this is a slightly different piece of that, but there are still a lot of people out there that don't have computers or don't use computers, and if we only notice the city sent out on computers, there are going to be some people that take care of or pay attention to that stuff that don't get those notices. So it's just a concern I've had in the past, and so that's why I wanted to bring it up.
And Representative Nelson, I share your concern. We spent a good chunk of money last year in broadband to try to get more of Minnesota connected to the Internet and to be able to make that tool available to people. We would want to move very, very cautiously, making that the only vehicle in which we would disseminate information. I concur with you on that. So there are no other member questions. Representative Swazinski, we will give you the final word on House File 1242 as amended, sir.
Thank you. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation. I appreciate the cities and the counties and also the members of the Midwest Hardware Association, the Minnesota Service Stations, the Retailers Association, the Grocers, and the Petroleum Retailers Association for working very hard on and diligently on this issue. We do have a bit to go, and I appreciate your support here, and I'd appreciate your support potentially on the floor at some time in the future.
Representative Swazinski renews his motion that House File 1242, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Representative Swazinski, you are on your way. Our next bill is House File 1519, Representative West. Representative West, welcome to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee, a committee you are very familiar with. Did you want to move House File 1519 before the committee?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 1519 to be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative West moves that the House File 1519 be re-referred to the General Register. That's our final destination for this. Representative West, to your bill.
Well, I took a special trip to Lund to make sure I had treats for everyone here. So I hope you enjoy them, and I also got a banana for Representative Nash since I knew he was feeling left out. This is one of those few bills that are, the summary is shorter than the actual bill. Provides for county license bureaus to be open at least 40 hours a week, strikes the requirement that they be open for at least 3 hours in the evening, one day a week. This was brought to me by the deputy registrars, and Jim Hirsch will be here to answer any questions if you have them, but I think the bill is pretty self-explanatory as is.
Representative West, thank you. Mr. Hirsch, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you're with, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hirsch. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Minnesota Deputy Registrars are your license centers or license bureaus across the state. There are 174 total across the state, and all deputy offices are regulated by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and to that extent, we are also subject to Minnesota rules, in this case, Chapter 7406. State rule states that all offices must be open a minimum of 40 hours a week. However, going back 35 years ago or so, there is existing statutory language that carves out an exception that says that if a deputy registrar office is considered a county license bureau, they are subject to being open for extended hours beyond the 40 hours. What House File 1519 seeks to do is make uniformity for all offices currently under Minnesota rule. And, for example, committee members, deputy registrar offices, of which are about 174 statewide, roughly one-third are operated by counties, one-third are operated by cities, and the remaining third are operated by private entities. However, of the one-third that are county-operated, only 15 are classified as a licensed bureau as opposed to a license center. So basically what this bill does is it provides more flexibility for these 15 offices across the state, of which three are in the metro area and 12 of them are in rural Minnesota. It just makes them subject to just a minimum of 40 hours, and certainly most offices are in operation for beyond that. So I will conclude my remarks. It's pretty straightforward, and we'll answer any questions you may have.
So if I understand the bill, we're making it more customer-centric, making more hours available for consumers to be able to do business that the state requires them to do. Is that what I'm hearing, Representative West?
Thank you, Chair, yes.
Very good. Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, the way I read this bill, it just does just the opposite. They only have to be open 40 hours each week, but they no longer are required to have evening hours or Saturday hours, so the person working an additional 9 to 5 Monday through Friday job would have to take off work to if these 15 locations that we talked about are where they can get their licenses. And if 15 and 12 of them are in all-state Minnesota, maybe the only place, unless they have to drive a long way to do their business, we're cutting down on the number of hours they're open and not making it more customer-centric and making it more difficult for our citizens of the state of Minnesota to renew their licenses, buy their tabs, all those fun things that are done at the county license bureaus.
Mr. Hirsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson. Deputy offices are very sensitive and go beyond the call of duty when it comes to trying to match up their hours to what customer demands are. For example, under current law, if an office wanted to stay open 1 or 2 hours beyond a typical 9 to 5, they would not be compliant with state law, because the state law says you have to be open for 3 hours beyond one day during the week or on a Saturday. These offices are not seeking this legislation to cut back their existing hours. but they would like the flexibility in the future should conditions change so that they're not running in opposition to current state law. So that's all we are seeking here. And certainly the bottom line is these offices are not interested in setting up hours of operation that are not conducive to the customers that we serve.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that good intentions of people and what was being said by the testifier that, you know, you want to be open when your business, when your customers are going to be able to use you, but the way I read this again, it's they have to be open 40 hours a week, they don't have to be open any late hours, they don't have to be open after 5 p.m. on any night or any time, they don't have to be open on Saturdays. It's basically, if they wanted to, they could go to straight 40 hours, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and they're not, they're going to comply with the law, and we're reducing the availability of our citizens to be able to deal with the business that they have to do unless they take off time from their own jobs. And so, Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to oppose the bill, and I'm going to ask for a roll call.
Roll call being required. Requested. Representative Nelson, I just want to follow a little bit of your logic on here. So it says that the current statute says they must be open at least 3 hours one evening. Can you share some experience that you've had in your district, how that one evening might have the number of people that have come in or on a Saturday morning that have come in to receive that, the services to buy tabs or different things as you suggested?
Mr. Chair and members, I guess I don't have any specific, but it's like I said, we're cutting back on that ability to have to do that, and not being open on Saturdays. And usually, when I was working a full-time job on Monday through Friday, it was either Saturdays I went or the evening that they were open, I would go take care of getting my tabs and that. But now, if I'm working a full-time job. And they comply with the law and they're only open Monday through Friday, I will have issues with getting tabs, buying those type of things, doing those type of things I have to do. So that's why I look at this as a cutting back. I don't look at that as opening it up. And granted, I trust that most of the county offices would probably say, yeah, we need to serve our customers, but they wouldn't have to. And, you know, we all know cases where people and do what they want to do and they, if I'm complying with the law, I don't have to be open later. So that's why I'm opposing the bill.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I understand that local control on this and what they do with that group of people in that particular area, because not everybody works 8 to 5 and maybe has to take off and work. Some people work on an emergency room at a hospital or provide health care and stuff and are on the evening shift, and maybe the days work better for them, or you're a contractor and you come in earlier in the morning and that's the group that they're needing to work with. So I just want to make sure I understand where we're going with the logic on why providing the flexibility isn't important.
Mr. Chair, like I said, it's the they still have to be open 40 hours a week. So all those people that are non-traditional shifts that would be able to get there during the day, it's not going to affect them. But I'm talking about the person that they work the 9 to 5, and the only time they have is in maybe that one night a week to deal with this, or the Saturday to deal with this, and you're cutting them out. Still a large proportion of our working people in the state of Minnesota work a traditional 9 to 5, 8-hour workday, 5 days a week, and so we're basically cutting them out.
So, Mr. Representative Nelson, I just wanted to make sure that I understood your understanding. It doesn't prohibit the licensing center from being open from noon to 9 o'clock if that's when they see the majority of the business and that's what the residents and the citizens and the population wants.
Mr. Chair, I agree that it doesn't do that, but like I said, it could be. This allows them to be able to be open 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, and that takes 40 hours, and a large portion of the population wouldn't be able to be able to access those county offices to do their business.
And Representative Nelson, then we've got a couple of member questions. I also want to understand the way that this is written right now. They could be open from 6 to 9, and there could be no one that's coming in, and we're paying wages and lights and utilities and things where no one's coming in. So they are required by statute to not have that flexibility. I just want to make sure I understand that correctly.
Mr. Chair, if that's what you understand, that's what you understand.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you. This is a really interesting bill, considering some of the legislation we've had recently. Again, I understand the 40 hours a week, but I still share Representative Nelson's concern, and I also recognize that very few government entities are open on Saturdays or evenings. I remember when we were on city, when I was on the city council, we did. There was one night a week where we tried being open later, and I think they discontinued that. So government does not have a really good history of doing what we're asking you to do. But again, because I think it's so important for people to be able to get the licenses, I really appreciate Saturdays and evenings being available. I will probably vote for this, but it's really important. And then just the fact that we just passed the Sunday liquor license, where liquor stores are open an incredible amount of hours, but yet it was so important that we give them open on Sunday. This makes, there's no consistency here, folks. I just want you to realize that some of us understand the lack of consistency here. I mean, there is none.
Representative Freiberg.
Just to follow up on Representative Nelson's point, I had my a few years ago, I had my town hall meeting at Robbinsdale City Hall with Representative Carlson and Senator Rest, and we do them usually on Saturday mornings. And there was a huge line of people, and I thought, oh my God, are all these people here to see us at our town hall meeting? No, they have a license bureau there, and everybody was there to get their licenses. So, you know, this bill would not require license bureaus to be open on at least one evening or one Saturday morning, like when I saw all those people there during my town hall meeting, and they weren't there for my town hall meeting.
So, Representative Freiberg, I my apologies if the people didn't want to come and see, and you know, that happens to me sometimes too. Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just respond quickly to a couple of the statements here. Number one, to your point, Representative Mason, actually this bill does provide for consistency. There are 174 offices statewide. Technically, 159 of them could be open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and that's it. And they would satisfy the requirements of the state rule. The vast majority of them do not. They have extended hours that are best suited to respond to the customers coming in to their facilities. Representative Freiberg, to your point regarding the Robbinsdale License Bureau, that is a city-operated License Bureau, and it is not subject to being open on a Saturday or extended hours. But again, they are responding to customer needs, and that's why that office was open on that Saturday. And so all we're looking for with this is to have these 15 offices be subject to the same standards that the vast majority of other offices are subject to. And I understand some individuals who may be concerned that this gives them the opportunity to reduce hours, but there's no indicate there is no desire on the part of these 15 offices to reduce their existing hours. Rather, again, they want uniformity with everyone else, and they want the flexibility moving forward, especially as you commented, Mr. Chairman, if there are times where there's no business coming in the doors, these offices are losing money because they have to have staff there with the doors open and nobody coming in. So with that, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kwan, followed by Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And correct me if I'm wrong, either the author or the testifier. I receive an envelope in with my, you know, when the tabs or a license renewal, of where I can avail myself of the Postal Service to take care of it, so I don't have to drive down to a location. And the so, and there's also a fixed number of customers total that use the service, you know, and so that you're saying because there's a fixed number and you want to have your business working, that you have a tendency to be open for business at hours the customers could utilize you. Otherwise, they could all choose to mail it in, and you would have no customers coming to your door. So I guess I'm less concerned about you know, your business is not being open, because they do have other options than to drive to your door. So I interpret it correctly?
Mr. Hurst.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, yes, there are certainly other options for the consumer to seek out satisfaction for their transactions. I won't go into detail, but we really want those customers to come into our offices rather than go to the state. But that's a whole other discussion, and I won't belabor the point, so thank you.
If this is not a finance committee, we're policy-related. Representative Quam, follow-up? Representative Halverson, followed by Representative Joachim. Representative Halverson passes. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this quick. I just want to point out that there are other things like title transfers on cars and having to get your picture taken. There's a lot of other opportunities to avail yourself of these services. But my quick question, you mentioned the 15. Are those the same 15, Mr. Hurst, that currently do the enhanced driver's license? Because I know there's very few places in the state that do that.
Representative Joachim, thank you for the question. Mr. Hurst, Representative
Thank
Joachim's
you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Joachim. Actually, thank you for asking that specific question. Enhanced driver's licenses are only offered by state-operated facilities, which happen to be about 15 statewide, or 14. We would love to be able to offer that service to the public, but
like
the Department
a new bill
of
coming.
Public Safety is not Department of Public Safety has not granted that to us. And again, that's another discussion. But no, we don't do EDLs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just knew there was a number out there that I was remembering.
And I won't ask who's going to do real ID, because that's another conversation for another day. Having seen no other member questions, is there any members of the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1519. Seeing none, Representative West, we'll give you the final word on the bill today, sir.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Nelson, I did ask these questions because I did briefly have those same thoughts, but the practice of the deputy registrars has always been to be open when their customers have needed them throughout all the history of the deputy registrars, because that's how they make their money. But I would like to renew my motion to refer this to the general register.
Representative West renews his motion that House File 1519 be re-referred to the general register. All those, we got a roll call. Good, I wanted to see how this one came out. The clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton? Freiberg?
No.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Lee?
No.
Mason?
Yes.
Nash?
Yes.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Quam?
Nah.
Representative Quam, is that no or yes?
Mr. Chair, are we only allowing English?
Representative Quam, that would be that's what we prefer, is if we use
you prefer
English,
to use the English language.
Yes.
So I can use yay, yes,
or I. That would work, yes. So all of the above, yeses?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Sandstead?
No.
Swidzinski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Joachim?
No.
Those are re-election.
There being 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail. We will be re-referring House File 1519 to the General Register. And with that, we have one other bill, and I'm going to ask Representative Joachim to chair that. And before we are done, I'm just going to ask Representative Joachim to toss it back to me. And Representative Bernardi for House File 1147 is making her way to the testifying table.
Taking a walk.
Thank you.
Representative Joaquin, did you need me to add on to your list of notes here from this?
go for it. Draw me a picture, too. Hello, Representative Benary. I'm going to move your bill 1147 to the General Registry, or that's House File 1147. Would you like to proceed to testify, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here today with a human resource manager from, you'll know why I said excuse me when I said a human resource manager when you see this bill. So the long and short of it, Ramsey County is here today, and they sought me out to change and make some updates to several sections of Chapter 383A, which relates solely to governance of Ramsey County. More specifically, this House File 1147 would amend language and three human resource-related provisions. These changes are entirely non-controversial. They did pass through the committee last year. They were waiting for floor action, and with everything happening at the end of session, they didn't actually get through on the floor. They didn't come up for a vote. So when other updates are happen throughout the state on these type of government operations, sometimes, generally, they get cross-referenced to Ramsey County statute, but in this case, in these cases, they were not included. And as a result, some of these are very outdated. And so I have with me today a manager from Ramsey County who works on employment issues, and her name is Jean Bramley, and we'll be brief, and I see this committee really likes to go in depth on their bills, so if you would like more information, we would be happy to share that with you.
Madam Chair,
go ahead, Ms. Bramley.
Thank you for the My name is Jean Bramley. Thank you for the opportunity. We have three areas of our personnel act that we're looking to make some adjustments to. The first one is on the duration of the eligible list. Right now the statute says an eligible list has to be in effect for 6 months, and we're looking to eliminate that requirement for 6 months and just allow the duration of the eligible list for hiring process to be set by the HR director at the point that we are getting ready to post for a position. That will enable us to be more efficient in our processes and fill positions more quickly. As things are getting tight, are tightening up now as we move into the employment market. The second section that we're looking at to make a change to is merely a housekeeping item to change the outdated language of personnel to a more contemporary term of human resources. So anywhere it references personnel, it would just be changed to human resources or Department of Human Resources. The third part is just eliminating the language in Section 383A.295 that requires individuals to retire by the age of 70. It is contrary to federal law, and it's also not consistent with the values and the mission of Ramsey County. That's all I have for now, unless you have some questions that you need.
Representative Bernardi, any follow-up before I go to member questions?
Nope, that's fine. Thank you.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Bernardi, I'm really excited to see that we're repealing the age limit, the 70, with having so many more active, fit 70-year-olds. It's nice to see we're taking that requirement out, because what else are we going to do with them? I know if my dad's home too much, my mom goes nuts. So I think we're keeping marriages together. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a statement and a basically to remind people in this committee, when we get these bills, sometimes the bills will say statutory and homeroom city, and it applies to all of those. But Ramsey County, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but they've got a special section of law, and when we just say statutory and homeroom cities, that exempts Ramsey County. So we need to make sure that we can see. And sometimes we pass laws like, I'm sure the 70-year-old retirement has been taken out of law in other places, but it must have been missed here because the bill that did it probably was not written properly to catch them.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other member comments or questions? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify? Well, Representative Bernardi, sometimes it's good to go last.
Yeah, maybe. Well, thank you for letting me, Madam Chair, for letting me go last. And
any follow-up that you'd like to?
No, thank you for your time, and I appreciate your service and support in getting this through this session in a timely manner.
Then I would renew my motion to move House File 1147 to the General Registry. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Same sign for opposed. Thank you. It moves to the General Registry.
Thank you, members. I hope you can still get your lunches.
And then actually Representative O'Driscoll had a few more comments.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. Next week is going to be a busy week as well. We will get information out as we get more of the rulemaking kinds of things that we were looking at. Tomorrow we'll start at 9 o'clock. We've got a number of bills that are on there. Even though it's posted from 9 to noon, we don't have to go to noon if we get our work done, but we're thinking that we want to make sure that we have an adequate amount of time to be able to address those things. Since we've accomplished our work today, there will be no carryover bills from today for tomorrow, so that's good news. And just for members' reference, 9 o'clock, and we are going to be in which room? In our home. We got a home game tomorrow. We're here in the basement hearing room, so we'll see you at 9 o'clock. We are adjourned.